Chapter 11. December 11th. Mountain of Lies. The deeper into Cheyenne Mountain Al went, the better he felt. This mission mattered. It was progress, and it might yet bring them a win. He'd had a hell of a time getting out here, but he'd made it at last. The problem hadn't been finding a jet that worked or even a crew. It had been gathering enough fuel. But this place, this was the Air Force as it ought to be. These people didn't feel a constant sense of threat, and you could hear the difference in the firmness of a step or an easy ripple of laughter in the canteen. Morale here was very far from the redoubt in West Virginia, where the whole dismal picture was on everybody's mind all the time. These people were winners. They were used to victory. They had no idea they were on the damn Titanic, and he tried to project confidence he did not feel. Nothing must disturb morale like this. A young captain led him down into the test area. She looked maybe 30. She was clean and well-groomed. She smiled, and she moved along ahead of him, her static-free shoes whispering against the pavement. It was in this test bed that human beings would, today for the first time, remove a living soul from the body that contained it. Once the soul was extracted, they would find its frequency and destroy it. This would be the first such execution. The prisoner was a monster, presumably from the federal ADX in Florence, Colorado, and after this death, not even what of him that had been eternal would remain. This might have extended benefits, because if reincarnation was real, it would mean that this horrible soul would never return to life. Maybe the reason that crime was always with us was that the souls of criminals returned just like everybody else, and were criminals again. Maybe, if the war was won, we could learn to pick and choose who would survive in eternity and who would not. But this was only one aspect of the experiment. Of greater importance was understanding just how souls and bodies connected, so that some defense against the light could be devised. The disks were methodically following the night around the world, striking the entire planet all the time, and so far no attack, not with hydrogen bombs, not with neutron bombs, not with any form of conventional weapon, had affected them. The British and French had concentrated on the most isolated lenses, exploding nuclear ordnance over them, in the ground near them, pulsing them with electromagnetic waves, even firing artillery shells into them. The U.S. had concentrated on the one on Easter Island, going back again and again, and with full imperial approval, but with equally dismal results. A unit of Marines had deployed around the lens and opened fire when the disks came out, but they were themselves made of light, and ordnance simply passed through them. Now, however, all that was ended. Communications had been jammed planet-wide. Satellites were dark. Broadcast transmitters had been disrupted by artificially induced changes in the Earth's ionosphere, and landlines by powerful electromagnetic pulses being continuously emitted from deep space. The objects responsible ringed the planet, 14 of them, each one 22,000 miles above one of the lenses. Even though they weren't in precise geostationary orbit, astronomers using old-fashioned backyard telescopes, which were the only ones that still worked, said that they showed no sign of moving off course. Military communications had been reduced to single sideband radio, sometimes, and a couple of fiber optic networks that had pulse-hardened switching stations that so far were impervious to the electromagnetic energy being beamed from above. The beautiful young captain paused before a steel door, input a number code. The door slid open. Beyond it was a tunnel with a pronounced downward slope. At the head stood a small stainless steel car. It was mounted on a black strip that descended, it seemed, into oblivion. "This is the railhead," she said, as she got into the car. It looked like an amusement park ride, he thought, but when she closed the door, the seal seemed very tight. He found himself looking out a small windshield at a concrete tunnel with conduit running along its ceiling. She pressed a button, and the car began moving with startling silence and smoothness. What propulsion? Maglev. He'd never seen any of this before, but just the scope of it all, riding this silent, efficient little train deeper and deeper, made him dare to consider again the possibility of victory. "We've reached cruising speed, sir." "Which is?" 280 clicks, sir." "You're kidding." "Sir, you're going to see a lot of wonderful machinery today. I mean, some of the stuff down here. Sir, this is a new world." He glanced at his watch, calculating in his head. 280 clicks an hour was a little over 4.5 kilometers a minute, so they'd gone almost 3 miles. He made a note of the time. "What's your first name, Captain?"
"Jennifer, sir. General Bert Maisel's my old man. I'm third-generation Air Force, sir."
He'd never heard of Bert Maisel, but all generals were supposed to know each other. The mythical first name club. "Old Bert," he said. "Sure." Whoever he was, old Bert had surely produced a handsome specimen of a daughter. Bright, too, or she wouldn't be in the mountain. Al had not thought about sex in a long time. He'd been attracted to many women, but every time he'd tried to start a relationship, he just lost direction. He still kept his picture of his sissy in his wallet, with her brightness and her smile, looking up from their table in the Wright Pat Officers Club where they used to go dancing. Her expression held surprise at being photographed, her eyes joy. Her skin shone with sweat because they'd just come back from a vigorous rumba. A year later, she had said, "Al, I need you," and fallen over in the middle of the bedroom, dead before she hit the floor. It had been a massive aortal aneurysm. She was 38 years old.
"You doing okay, General?"
"I'm fine."
"You weren't need to know on this part of the project, were you?"
"Apparently not. I thought I was need to know on everything."
She smiled at him.
"Then look at this as the adventure of a lifetime, because that's what it's going to be."
"What about our prisoner?"
"Gonna die. That's what we call it."
"What's his crime?"
"Dunno, sir. Bad boy, though. Not a friend of ours."
"No. I suppose not. Do we know for sure that the soul persists outside the body?"
"For sure, sir. We've taken them out and put them back in."
"Really?"
"We're making strides, sir. Catching up fast. We know for certain that when the body is killed, the soul does not die or lose its integrity. It can be destroyed, though."
"How?"
"Certain frequencies make it fly apart. Trillions of electrons, all organization gone, tiny bits of consciousness flying off into space forever."
He had to think that this progress was brilliant. They were racing against time down here, but at this rate, they might just learn enough to actually win this thing.
"Could we give the wanderers back their souls?"
"It's conceivable."
"That would be a hell of a victory right there.
It'd ruin somebody's day for sure.
The god-for-damned enemy's day."
"That would be true."
Another glance at his watch. They'd traveled 7 miles, meaning that they weren't under Cheyenne Mountain anymore. He put his foot against the footrest and leaned back. The little transporter, about the size of a jeep, was now passing under the thickest conduit he'd ever seen. A black, endless river affixed to the cut stone of the wall with heavy steel wrapping that flashed past hypnotically as they sped along. On either wall were light fixtures about every 50 feet, but glowing so softly that they did not completely penetrate the darkness.
Looking ahead through the windshield, it was as if an endless stream of lit portholes were coming up on either side, then speeding past the side windows as a continuous streak.
That conduit carry power?
A lot of power. You need it to change the patterns of the electrons, disrupt the frequency of a soul. It becomes confused. Then you just keep ratcheting up the power until, bang, it flies apart. Humpty Dumpty.
You've killed some down here before.
Couple dozen.
But just the bodies, not the souls.
Taking them out. Soul surgery. Today's our first try at a kill.
But the ones you took out, where did they go?
Her face clouded, and she fell into what he could only interpret as a sullen silence. It was as if he'd insulted her. But how? What was the big deal if there was some part of the thing they didn't understand yet? They were now 18 miles in. 18 goddamn miles. Where was this place? Who had built it, and when? He recalled that on September 12, 2001, the Secretary of Defense had announced that the Defense Department had lost $1 trillion, and he thought that projects like this might be an explanation. They'd been working on this a long time then, because facilities like this take years to construct. Hell, generations. And trillions of dollars, for sure. 22 miles.
We're also descending, aren't we?
Yes, sir.
And?
We're at 6,000 meters at this time, sir.
Holy God. That was 20,000 feet, 18 miles in and 4 down.
Why so deep? You don't want the souls getting away, and they are slippery, sir, very slippery.
They know what's happening to them, then?
They're alive. Never forget that. If you start messing with a soul, it wants to get away from you, and it's smart. If one escaped, the enemy would see it immediately and know what we were up to. So we're deep. Best place for us to be.
What kind of lookdown do you have?
Sir?
Satellite lookdown? Guardianship?
None since last week, but we're guarded by a unit of air police and fully sensor-protected.
In other words, the facility was totally exposed. If the enemy got so much as an inkling of what was happening down here, they were coming around, and right now...
The car slowed to a stop. We've reached stage 2, sir. Time to move to the lift for the rest of the trip. Stay seated. There's going to be an equalization.
The door sighed, and there was a jarring pop, and Al's ears rang. What in hell is this?
We're at 4 atmospheres down here, sir.
When they stepped out, the ceiling was so low that Al had almost to crouch. The chamber was hewn out of solid basalt, gleaming black walls scarred by drill trenches. It was also very, very confined. He was aware of the miles of stone overhead and all around him. It was like being in a coffin. How could anything have been drilled this deep in a military facility without the Joint Chiefs being told?
How long have you been down here?
She glanced at him, but said nothing. She ushered him into an elevator that looked like some kind of meat locker. It was heavily insulated, with a very small cab. It contained bench seating for 4 people around its steel walls. There were seat belts. He asked her,
"Are these needed?"
She buckled herself in.
"Advisable."
There was a clank and a whirring sound, then a sucking whine, and Al was practically lifted against the ceiling. Scrabbling hard, he got the ends of his belt and managed to strap himself in.
"We're going down a further 3 miles," she said.
3 miles straight down, after another 35 laterally and 9 down. It was inconceivable. There was no technology he knew of that could accomplish this. But obviously somebody did know, and they had been experimenting on souls down here for a long time.
"It's a Manhattan Project for the Soul instead of the A-bomb," he said. "That's right on the money, sir. Need to know's spread very thin." "Samson?" "Project director."
The man was a shit, but he surely knew how to keep a secret.
"Impressive. I never guessed."
The elevator hummed and jostled slightly as it descended. Confinement disturbed him, and truth to tell, the closer they got to actually doing it, the more uneasy the idea of killing a soul was making him. He was not really seeing how even the worst criminal deserved destruction like this. It felt like they were intruding into God's business. Actually, he wished he could call Samson and request that this be at least postponed. Even if he'd somehow managed the call, though, Tom would never allow it. He'd consider the request treason, and he wouldn't be wrong. We had to learn everything we needed to learn to defeat that light, and if some criminals were denied eternal life in our quest for answers, then that was too damn bad. The elevator stopped.
"Gonna be another pop," she said. "Open your mouth."
She pressed a button and the door slid back. This time, there was a loud thud and a sensation of being hit in the chest with a medicine ball.
"Wow!
7 atmospheres, she said.
They walked out into a tiny chamber with black, sweating walls. It was maybe 5 feet wide, 7 high, not much bigger than the interior of a coffin. On the far side was a door, equally black.
"What is this, the entrance to hell?"
She laughed.
"It is."
He followed her down a steep corridor, then deeper still, down a winding metal staircase so narrow that he could hardly manage to negotiate it. They descended for easily 20 minutes, and he thought that coming back up was going to be a battle. Now the two of them were in a chamber that really was the size of a biggish coffin. Embedded in one wall was another black door, this one with a round window in it like the bulging eye of an insect. "You'll need to disrobe, please."
"Excuse me?"
"Take off your clothes, General. You'll be provided with a special suit, so it won't kill your soul too, General."
"What about you?"
"I stay out here, sir."
He took off his tunic, his tie, his shirt, while she watched impassively. He waited, but she did not turn around. Finally, he removed his shoes and trousers. He waited again.
"Ma'am, could you give me some privacy?"
She turned then and faced the wall. He could understand her reluctance. She now had a face full of basalt. When he was naked, he faced the door. It was eerie, the way the dark porthole seemed almost like something alive. "The prisoner is ready," she said, and the door began slowly to open. Before him, there appeared the most astonishing thing he had ever seen. The room was painted vividly, with images right out of the interior of a fabulous Egyptian tomb. Lines of men, a god in a golden headdress, prisoners standing stiffly, strange objects that looked like giant vacuum tubes.
"What the hell is going on here?"
Then he saw a stack of what looked like the same vacuum tubes in real life. There were men in the room, too, dressed in black uniforms without insignia.
"Excuse me, gentlemen, but I need something to wear."
Nobody took any notice of him. They were clustered around the vacuum tubes, which were attached to thick cables that came out of the walls. He saw only backs. Some of the rigid figures in the relief painting had cables thrust down their throats, and the tubes attached to the other ends of these were brightly lit. Others still were being intubated, their heads thrown back, their guts distended, as black-painted soldiers just like these men pushed the cabling down their throats. Others waited, their faces turned away.
"Look, I need that coverall now, please, gentlemen."
Behind him, he heard a loud thunk. He turned toward the sound, which proved to be the door closing. The young captain had come in after all. Ready to explode in her face, he turned around and just plain stopped dead. Her eyes regarded him with a doll-like emptiness that did not look alive. Immediately he remembered his dream of 2 nights ago, that face, geisha-like, staring at him. It was her. She smiled a little. "Hello again." He threw himself past her. She didn't try to stop him. On the contrary, she stepped aside with the grace of a matador. He sought some way of opening the door, sweeping his hands across its smoothness. There was no handle. There was no lock. She watched, completely impassive. He stopped. His heart was hammering so hard that he thought he might simply drop dead from the shock. He tried to talk, but his mouth was too dry. He hesitated to think who these people must be, but he did think it. They were the enemy. That was why the blackness of the uniforms was so bizarre, as if they were literally dressed in night. A powerful realization came to him, of the sort that will come to a dying man. It told him that it was sin that generated that blackness, that they were not in uniforms at all, but were as naked as he was. "Your soul isn't going to be killed," she said from behind him. Her voice was, well, it was musical. And yet, there was something else in it, something that he could only think of as rage, and maybe deeper rage than he had ever heard before. Or no, he had heard that rough, bitter tone before. "Samson is one of you." "Indeed." She put her hand on his shoulder. "Come on," she said. "You can make this easy or you can make it hard." She was wary. She knew that he was dangerous. "I don't want you to imagine you have any chance to get out of this," she said. And then she shuddered, for all the world like a dog shaking its hide. The uniform fell away, and he saw that it wasn't actually a uniform at all, but something thin and now dry. It looked like skin shed by a snake. Her real skin shimmered, and her face changed. She blinked her eyes, and the sockets were round. Blinked them again, and they were long. Now a nictitating membrane came across the eyeballs, and when it retracted, he found himself face to face with the most beautiful and awful thing he had ever seen. The face was that of a snake or a lizard, but flattened and extended so that it covered the front of a human-sized head. It was softly angled, sleek, with a snake's fixed lips. There was a smile, though, sparkling in the golden eyes, which were an incredible contrast to the human eyes she'd been exhibiting a few moments ago. These eyes were sparkling with life and humor, and he could see it so clearly. Glee! There was an earthly equivalent to these creatures. They were chameleons. But these, they were far, far more evolved than any earthly shapeshifter. And he suspected also now why Samson carried his syringe. He wasn't an addict. To live on the surface, they must need some kind of support. Allergies, diseases. He'd probably never know what endangered them there. "Now, I want you to try to stay calm, Al. The less you fight, the less this will hurt. You need to understand that we have no mercy, Al. We have no mercy." The eyes twinkled. "So, it's up to you. This can be a terrible agony for you, or it can go smoothly. Up to you, Al. Up to you." The others were working with their equipment. Al watched the nearest one turn toward him. He was as black as night. His skin had the polish of a jewel. It shimmered as he moved, sleek muscles rippling within. He drew a black tube out of the wall and approached Al. As he moved forward, the tube made a faint hissing sound. The end, which appeared to be made of copper, glowed with a curious green light.
"We've already tested you on this," Jennifer said. "We know it's going to work."
A huge emotion filled him. This wasn't just death. It was worse. It was the absolute end of his being. Soul murder. He hadn't practiced his martial arts in years, but he called his old skills up from the very depths of his being, moved to a back stance, and tried a sidekick. The creature caught his foot and slammed him to the floor. He took the hit, tried to shake it off, failed. The female made a string of sounds, and then, unmistakably, they all laughed. It was quiet, easy laughter, the laughter of men running a slaughter line, joking about something else as they slit the throats of the pigs. The one who had taken him down turned away and continued his work, which involved screwing a copper fitting onto one of the strange glass tubes. Al got to his feet. He was feeling a dull, hopeless sort of determination. His own greed had brought him here. He'd taken the assignment from Samson despite the fact that he knew damn well that something was very wrong. He had done this out of eagerness for promotion, and that even though the entire system was hopelessly broken and none of it made a bit of difference. They had seen his ambition and used it against him to lure him very neatly into this trap. He had been more than willing to come down here and kill another human being's soul, so why was he now being so careful of his own? But he was. He had a touch of eternity in him. He could feel it clearly. And he did not want it to die. He did not want it so much that this time he really lashed out at the female who had come close to him. His blow connected, and her head bounced to one side as he gave her the hardest knuckle slap he could manage. Then he waded in, fists pounding, but each time he struck a blow, less seemed to happen. It was like fighting wet cotton. And she watched him impassively as he slowly became unable to move at all. Just like the victims in the relief, he was soon standing frozen, arms at his sides. One of the males now strolled over to him. The female pointed at a particular painting and spoke a few words. The painting showed a prisoner having his eyes gouged out. One of his captors went to it, looked at it for some moments, then opened a black case like a thick pocket knife. There was a pop, followed by hissing. The thing became like a tiny star in his hand, fiercely bright. He approached Al. His eyes were emptier than hers, narrow and yellow-green, not gold. As Al watched, the nictitating membranes slid quickly over the pupils, then disappeared back into the orbits. The star was brought close to his face. It was hot, and he tried to turn away but could not move a millimeter. Now it began to burn around his lips. Then there was a sizzling sound, and he tried to cry out but instead found himself gagging on his own blood. When the light was withdrawn, blood poured down, spattering on the floor, washing his feet and the fleshy remains of his lips in thick red sheets. His mind blanked. He knew that he was being slaughtered, was aware of it, but distantly. Shock does that, even to a soldier. An instant later, what appeared to be a red serpent's tongue darted out of the object, striking his left eye, causing a bright red flash in his brain. He heard muscles pop and felt torment in his neck as his body literally tore itself to pieces in its effort to move against the invisible restraints that bound it. He did not understand that he had been placed on an electrically charged plate that neutralized his nervous system, stopping all communication between brain and body. He also did not understand that all this equipment was not only old, but simple, simpler by far than most man-made circuitry. He did not understand that these creatures were not advanced beyond man in most science, but only in one science, the science of the soul, which made these exhausted, half-starved, and poverty-stricken beings appear like dark gods to him, as the Spaniards, sick, starving, and far from home, had once appeared to the Aztecs. He never dreamed that the operators were tired and bored and longing to be home with their own wives and lovers, and did not themselves fully understand why they were here or what they were doing. He did not know that the young female's happiness came from the fact that she would get a great deal of credit and power if the monster she was creating was successful. He didn't even begin to understand what it was, that it would be used to penetrate into another universe and end a threat that had appeared there. It was a human universe, and one that they had known about for thousands of years. They could even enter it to some extent, but not so completely that they could actually do something there as complex as finding a computer file and destroying it. They could enter that universe only with clumsy thrusts, not with the kind of precision they now needed. The world went black, and he wanted to howl out his rage and his absolute terror, but those abilities were not available to him. Nothing was available to him. He was a bright spark called Al. That was all. That and pain. Waves of it. Gushers of it. Boiling oceans of it. Then he felt fingers moving his genitals, and then yet more pain, this time radiating up from there, and he knew that he had been castrated. Through the agony, Al began to get the odd feeling that he was rocking, as if he was in a boat or on a swing. He had no way to know that the surgery he had just undergone had shattered the specialized nerve endings that bound the electromagnetic organ that was the soul to the physical one that was the body. This was one way to do it. The shearing light was another. The moment the coring and cutting was complete, the rocking became a bizarre, sensationless lurching, and the room seemed to race past him, the figures in it whizzing and spinning as his vision, freed from the limitations of his eyes, saw everything around him at once. He was manipulated as casually as if he had been a moth captured between the fingers of a cruel child. And yet, the connections between body and soul remained strong, and when one of the creatures thrust his thumbs into the base of Al's jaws, he felt it pop as his blood-gushing mouth gaped. The next sensation Al felt was very like what he'd experienced during his nightmare the other night, the same choking, gagging sense of being invaded down his gullet. One of the thick cables, with its frayed, cracking insulation, was being brought up and pushed down his throat. It hurt 1,000 times more than what had been done the other night, and what happened to his mind was similar, but 1,000,000 times more powerful. He gagged. His body tried to choke the thing out of him, but strong hands pushed it deep. The other night, they'd been sifting his thoughts to see if he would come to understand who they really were and what they were doing, and therefore, if he might betray their plans on his way into their trap. He gagged furiously. He tried to make sounds. He tried to scream out warning to the world that the United States was actually under the leadership of the invaders, that traitor Samson's flyers were indeed intended to deceive people into congregating, and Samson had used some sort of mind control to induce the president to commit suicide, and now Al was down here being destroyed, the one person who might have been able to get in Samson's way. He was here, because he'd been about to figure out that Samson was one of them. Like pages from a book, the living pages of his soul swept from his body and into a new state. Around him, he saw blue glass, and beyond it, the lithe and gleaming figures moving in the extraction chamber where his body now lay in a bleeding heap. He saw them take the parts they had cut off and push them into a hole. He was stuck to the filament inside one of the huge glass tubes. The filament was inside him, and his whole soul was on fire. His soul was burning.
"Nice," the female said in English. "We're done, General."
The tube was now filled with him, a plasma of electrons that shimmered with a million different colors, sparking and recoiling when it hurled itself against the glass wall again and again. The captain made a series of statements, speaking in her soft, swift voice. Two of her helpers lifted the tube as the third pulled the cable out of its worn bronze socket. They placed the tube into a larger socket in the floor. Al could see them, but he could not speak. He could not scream out. Above all, he could not get out of the tube. He watched them slide his body into an ordinary military-issue body bag. Then two of them lifted it onto their shoulders and carried it out. As the door slid closed behind them, Al saw them taking it off into the depths of the facility. When the door closed, darkness came. Absolute. Then, not quite. There was a glow, fitful, that he realized came from this tube. What light was left in this dark chamber of hell was the light of his soul. Part 2. The Ruin of Souls. Saint Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the power of God, cast into hell Satan and all the evil spirits, prowling throughout the world, seeking the ruin of souls. Pope Leo XIII, Prayer to Saint Michael the Archangel. This is the hour of lead, remembered, if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow. First chill, then stupor, then the letting go. Emily Dickinson. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. Chapter 12. December 18th, evening. Children of Mystery. Martin had been lying so still for so long that he had lost sensation from the waist down. His legs were not there at all. His torso was as cold as a corpse. He was famished and freezing. He'd been on the move for days, going from house to house, sleeping in attics and storm cellars, anywhere that offered a decent seal against the return of the light. He was home now, hiding in his own crawl space. All of this time, he'd been looking for Trevor. He'd given up on Winnie and Lindy. They were beyond his help now, given that following was a trap. As an American, he had not felt vulnerable in the same way that so many people did in this world, perpetually frightened that their loved ones might simply disappear some night. That didn't happen here, and he had not anticipated the extraordinary emotional wear and tear that losing your loved ones brought. It was so emasculating that he had to fight just becoming passive. He did this by creating a goal for himself. His goal was Trevor. He'd searched half the houses in the smokes by now. He was planning a night raid into the town soon, too. Night after night, the light had scoured Harrow, Kansas, and he doubted that many people were left by now. The same was true of the smokes. It came here every night, seeking and probing. And those other things came, too, the shadowy things that he'd encountered when he was a follower. Thunder bellowed. Another storm was coming. Soon there would be more rain. Methane releases from permafrost, the collapse of the Greenland and Antarctic glaciers, the flooding of polar oceans with fresh water from the melt, the wild state of the sun, all of these things were combining to make the weather turn dangerous just when this horrific attack occurred. For years, the U.S. had pleaded with the empires to curtail pollution, but they would not touch their development zones. Industrializing regions of Africa and South Asia had completely overwhelmed the planet's ability to maintain balance. More planning on the part of these invaders? He feared so. He feared that they might have infiltrated every colonial administration on Earth. No doubt they would turn out to be comfortable in an atmosphere choked with what we thought of as pollution. Despite the sodden cold of the crawl space, he sweated. The silence was deep now. His watch told him that sunset was not far away. He had a mission tonight, aside from avoiding the light and the other menaces. He intended to track down a sound he'd heard off and on that came from down toward the Saunders. Drumming, he thought. Somebody down there, perhaps. Of course, in this world it was impossible to tell. Could be anything. Some creature from hell, or an alien machine. Or it could be people. And if so, there were more than one or two of them. He stirred a little, just moving his body slightly. Then he waited. There was no sound from above. He raised his left hand and pressed it against the trap door. After a moment, he pressed harder, causing the door to move just slightly. When there was no reaction, he pushed the door all the way open. He made his way through the dining room, then the living room, where he had spent so much time in his chair reading, where he had read to his kids, where he had listened to the music he loved. The front door gaped. As he went through, he tried to push it closed, but it was no use. They'd torn it off its hinges. He stepped into the grass, in the long shadows of evening. He listened, heard nothing. No, it was a night sound, that drumming, and finding its source was about the only thing he could conceive of that would draw him outside after the sun went down. Then he heard another sound, a great whooshing overhead that was familiar to him from his night as a follower. He glimpsed, turning hard against the clouds that raged above, what looked like a gigantic bat. He could feel it watching him, knew that it was. And then he heard from the woods behind the house that familiar mechanical clatter. The sun was not yet down, but the alien animals were already stalking him. The bird was the spotter, and whatever was in those woods he suspected was there to tear him apart. He scrambled down the hill toward the stream, and then moved along its bank, rattling the dry autumn brush as he went through it. Tears swarmed his eyes. He was that afraid, as above him the wheeling bird wailed, and the woods behind him and around him echoed with the noise of whatever monstrosities were there. He came to the little lake, really just a widening of the Saunders, where he sometimes swam in the summer, and ran out onto its pier. Forcing himself not to dive, he slipped into the frigid water and moved under the pier, clinging to one of its slippery pilings, concealed by the three rowboats that were there, old Mrs. Lane's little white dinghy that she used to fish for crappies, and his boat that could be fitted with a small sail and go racing across the 30-acre lake, and the third boat, a duck hunter's craft, camouflaged, that had not been used by anybody in years. Then he heard his pursuers, their feet splashing softly, and heard their sounds, mutterings, clatterings, small whistles that he realized were a language, and a complex one, and he wondered then if these might be the real aliens, or if they were creatures that had been trained like dogs, or were smarter than dogs, and then if they might be constructed things, machines brought to life. There came tapping, a claw tip on the wooden dock above his head. He heard the eager whisper of their breath, and the more intimate clattering of what he thought now must be mouth parts. There was a whisper in that clattering that suggested knife blades, steel against steel. From high overhead there came the long wail again, and he could hear in it, quite clearly, a tone of angry question. Had they lost him? Something slid into the water. It was clear and deep, the little lake, with tall water weeds that rose up from its darkness, and he saw, sailing below him, a huge shadow, blacker than black, with eight great legs outstretched around it. He watched it sailing above the gently waving fronds coming toward him, and felt, as it came closer, more frozen, more helpless. This was his death, then, his ugly destiny, and he'd done nothing to deserve it. The thing in the water made a graceful turn, and then came back toward the dock. He watched the shadow glide closer. He'd lost. He'd been captured. And now, he thought, his lot must be to share the fate of the mangled boy he'd seen in the field. Perhaps he should fight more. But he didn't know how. If he swam, the thing would be on him in a second. If he got out, he'd have to confront the ones crowding the dock. Something brushed his leg, feeling like a whipping frond of waterweed, and he saw the shadow darting there. It was closing in. It was about to strike. He shut his eyes, waited, heard a sloshing sound, very light. Sick with fear, but unable to bear the feeling that he was about to sustain an attack, he opened them again. There was a girl in the water beside him. She cocked her head and raised her eyebrows, then held a long finger across her lips. She looked sketched by a Dutch master. She was so flawless, so full of glow. And also, she looked familiar, very much so, but he couldn't place her. He was trembling with the cold of the water. She reached a hand like a sparrow to his shoulder, and warmth came from it, soothing him and bringing him a startling sense of protection. She raised a finger beside her ear and shook her head. "Don't listen," the gesture said. Then she held her hand out before her, palm toward him. The message was clear. Don't listen, and don't move a muscle. But how could he not listen to that hideous wailing in the sky? It was the most terrifying sound he'd ever heard, and the mechanical chuckling of what appeared to be gigantic spiders gnashing their mouthparts, it caused sickening dread, visceral terror, as it conjured thoughts of agonizing mutilation. She frowned at him. What was she getting at? And who was she? So familiar, the face. She smiled softly, and he thought that certain female looks define the very essence of beauty for the male. And she reached out as if she had heard that thought, and touched his cheek so very kindly. And his mind went to Lindy, and his heart almost broke in half. This all happened in an instant, during which time she touched her temple and nodded and smiled, and that gesture, one he had seen her make before, caused him to realize who she was. This was Louise Wright's daughter, Pammy, manager of the Target, and he thought she could read his mind. He noticed also that as he had become distracted by her, the things in the water seemed to have lost track of him. There was a crackle, a huge noise, electronic crackle. Pammy Wright frowned. A voice echoed, electronically amplified. "Martin Winters, I am Captain Jennifer Maisel of the United States Air Force. Please come up on the dock." Pammy shook her head. Then she pointed downward and disappeared. "Dr. Winters, I am Captain Jennifer Maisel of the United States Air Force. The situation has been stabilized, and it's safe to come out. Please come up on the dock." He saw Pammy's pale body disappearing down among the water weeds. She swam right through a line of black shapes, which simply hung there, not moving. He followed her, going deep, swimming as hard as he could, struggling, and, he was sure, drawing attention to himself. He swam toward the creatures, which all spread their legs and began closing in on him. He dropped down into the water weeds, into the dark and the pressure among their roots, glimpsing a great fish, then Pammy again, far ahead, deeper yet in the lake. How could she do it? How could she possibly manage? Waves of frantic air hunger were already coursing through his body, and he was going to have to surface. He had no choice. It was essential to life. He could not manage another second. And then she was there, coming up from below, and she had with her a blue cylinder. She offered him a rubber tube and turned it on when it was in his mouth. As he gulped oxygen, tingling, exquisite relief filled his lungs, his blood, his crashing heart. She flitted away as a great, rough something whipped his back. He didn't turn to look, he just followed her. He couldn't suppress his fear now, not when he was swimming for his life. But what had that voice been? Was the Air Force really out there? Maybe he would have been safe if only... Pammy stopped, turned, and yelled in bubbles, "No!" He went deeper, following the disappearing form. The water was dark here. The pressure was making his ears ring, and his lungs were bursting again. Somebody else was beside him. A young man, as naked as Pammy had been, swimming hard, his eyes behind goggles also. He had the oxygen, which Martin took in huge gulps. He was being rescued by the town kids who had disappeared, and... oh, God, maybe that meant Trev. He swam hard and soon found himself in a narrowing, dark space, a tunnel. Where he was, he didn't know, but they were ahead of him, and he swam for all he was worth. Then something like steel springs grabbed both of his legs, and he began to be dragged back out of the tunnel, and he knew that it was one of the things, and he kicked and kicked, but the harder he tried, the tighter its grip became. Also, air was getting short again, and he was in too confined a space, nobody could reach him here. As he began to be dragged back, he clawed at the walls, he kicked with every ounce of his strength, but still, the grip on him tightened, and he knew that he had lost this struggle. He began to be pulled backward out of the tunnel, going faster by the second. He could soon see again. As he was pulled back into the body of the lake, light grew around him. The walls of the tunnel were stone. He could see them now, and he had a last chance here. He understood spaces like this, tunnels, tombs, and such. With all the strength that was in him, he thrust out his arms and the leg that wasn't in the grip of the thing that was dragging him. As the thing met sudden and unexpected resistance, he felt a flash of pain in the ankle it had been gripping. Immediately, he kicked, kicked again, kicked a third time, and felt himself come free. Then kicked harder as the legs or grippers or whatever they were scrabbled around his feet. He pulled himself back into the blackness and narrowness of the tunnel until he could barely move and had to breathe and knew that it would be water. And he did breathe, and it was water. It came sluicing down his throat and gagged him, causing him to cough and involuntarily draw in more. It hurt to drown. It was not magic. He saw nothing of his life before his eyes as he died, only agony, only a frantic need that could not be fulfilled, and then dark, dark, dark. Air, sweet in him, filling him. Air, but maybe only the air of wishes, the air of dreams. Come on! CPR him, hurry! Pressure on his back. A cough, water coming out, flowing out, then another breath, deep and good. And he was fully conscious again, wet, aware of how miserably cold he was. Dappled autumn woods, larks singing in the last high light, little moon racing in the clouds, beloved star wanderer, and her, Pammy, standing over him, and the young man, the boy, also familiar but no name, not yet. They dragged him to his feet.
Hurry!
High overhead, a long, chilling wail shattered the noise of the larks.
Don't listen.
Why not?
They home in on fear. If you're not afraid, they can't find you. Come on!
As she spoke, the young man sprinted away. She tugged at his arm.
We've got to go. They're realizing they made a mistake.
She smiled shyly, her cheeks and neck turning pink.
Somebody just said, "Who's back at the lake?" And now they're all looking at each other.
She lowered her eyes. You understand their language? She hauled at his hands, then slipped away as easily as if she had been born to the forest, her pale face glowing in a dark that was being brought by clouds that were speeding out of the north like hungry panthers, flashing and bellowing. She had already disappeared, and he ran to follow her, and was stopped by a devastating blow from behind. And then he saw the ground, felt cold leaves in his face.
I want you to be calm.
It was the Air Force officer, Jennifer Maisel. He cried out in the direction the girl had gone.
Help! Help me!
I'm a scientist too, Dr. Winters. I'm not going to hurt you.
Then let me up.
The weight lifted, and Martin pulled out from under her. She wore a camouflage vest, a rumpled hat, and heavy glasses with a split lens. Her eyes were big with sadness.
"This mission isn't going right," she said. "I need you to come back and help us."
"What are those things? My God, you need to help us understand, Dr. Martin.
They were trying to kill me. The government was, too."
She touched his hand, then gripped it.
"There's a lot of fear out there."
He glimpsed movement behind her. She started to turn, but was struck and hard by a piece of wood. She turned quickly back. Her face was distorted, the skin on the cheek where she'd been hit imprinted by the wood. She moved to one side, her skin rippling, turning cream-colored, red where the board had hit. What in the world was wrong with her? She snarled, came quickly toward him. Seen full on like this, her face was... Oh, holy Christ, it was... The skin was ripping like a crazy jello. The eyes were weird in the eerie cloud light, weird and gold. He turned and ran. He didn't think he was beyond that. He just ran, because what he had seen was so terrible that his mind had been completely stripped away, replaced by a terror so raw and so deep that this educated, civilized man was thrown back in an instant to the days when men were hunted things. A thunder of slashing jaws rose up all around him, as overhead the wails came again and again, exultant now, joyous now, the sky, the very air, vibrant with their triumph. His fear was the beacon, but he couldn't help it. She'd turned into a monster when that kid had hit her, and that had been the single most shocking thing Martin had ever seen, more shocking even than the explosion of the pyramid, which involved an inanimate thing, not the face of a living creature like that. And then Pammy was there, looking down at him from a ledge. She motioned to him, and he clambered up beside her. She lay flat, and he did the same.
"Blank your mind," she said calmly. "Concentrate your attention on your body. Don't think."
Lying on the sun-warmed stone, he concentrated on his aching lungs, his crashing heart. Below them, he heard movement, then quiet voices. Above, the wailing came and went as the great birds began to patrol.
"Come on," she whispered. "Fast!"
The instant she spoke, there was a rustling sound, and a black-gloved hand gripped the ledge from below. He turned and ran, following her, putting all the strength he had left into his effort. The trees shuddered, and the thunder echoed, and great gusts of wind swam down from the north. Martin ran behind the fleeing girl deeper and deeper into the woods, and rain came in sheets, a yellow deluge. Behind him he heard the cries of the strange birds and the crackle of alien voices. "Come on," Pammy urged. He could remember this part of the woods. They were past the Saunders and about a mile down from his house. This was state land, part of the Prairie Heritage Program. The forest here was as thick as it got in Kansas, and when you dropped down into the hollows, dense with brush. The hunting back in here had been excellent when he was a boy. Wild pheasant, plenty of turkey. Time's gone by. He'd discovered here that Trevor was not going to be a hunter, that he felt too bad for the animals. He and Lindy had come back in here when they were first married, and walked naked here, hand in hand, in some sort of sacred contact with the land that they could not articulate. It was miserable here now, though, soaking, the rain pounding down, wind roaring. A storm like this could easily bring a tornado, too. Then she seemed to drop down, as if into a hole. When he followed her, he discovered a tiny glade, and in it a camouflaged tent. He recognized it. They'd been on sale at Hiram Sporting Goods. She darted in. He approached more warily. Close to it he could hear drums and the sound of the rain. Then the flap opened, and she gestured frantically. He went in. The first thing he noticed was that the drumming was much louder. The second, that the air was stifling. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that the space was filled with children and young people, perhaps 20 in all. He knew at once that these were the kids who had disappeared when their parents and siblings had become wanderers. He looked from face to face, seeking recognition, not willing to taste again of his hope. When he did not see Trevor, he swayed, staring, helpless to either stand or sit. He had reached the end of his tether. He was going to collapse. Unable to defend himself from his own tears, he dropped to his knees and covered his face and fought to keep his tears silent. A hand came onto his shoulder.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry."
And the tears became a helpless, humiliating flood. "Dad?" He'd heard the word, but... "Dad?" He raised his face and saw standing before him somebody he did not recognize. "Dad, I'm Trevor." Then he did. Behind the dirt, behind the dark cast of his eyes, behind the wild hair and the muddy camouflage suit, he knew that it was his son. Trevor had changed fantastically. He was not a boy, not at all. His expression contained an adult's knowledge of the world, that and more. And the change had been so abrupt and so total that in just these few days he had become unrecognizable to his own father. The heart, though, the heart sees, and Martin's heart saw his son before him. He opened his arms and Trevor came to him, and he closed them around his son's narrow body. His heart and mind may have grown, but this was still the same boy, fragile almost, but with the long legs and big shoulders that said he would soon grow much taller. "Trevor," he managed to rasp. "Trevor." Trevor pushed gently at him, but he clung more tightly. He could never let him go, not ever. He could not do that again. "Dad, He managed to look up into his father's eyes. "Dad, nobody else here has any parents left." For a moment, Martin didn't understand. Then he did. He was the only parent who was not wandering. He looked out across the expectant faces, the eyes that he was realizing all had the same strange shadow in them. Some of them touched now by tears, others wide with sorrow, others resigned.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"I'm George," one of the older boys replied. "Glad to meet you." George held out his hand, shook formally. Others followed, most of them teens, some as young as 10. There were 22 of them, two more boys than girls. Each in turn introduced himself. It was so formal, oddly formal, but there was no precedent for such a meeting, was there? Through all of this, the drumming did not stop. Trevor glanced away from him, then murmured, "It drowns out the sound of the night riders so the little ones won't get scared." Just hearing his son's voice, Martin felt another wave of joy.
"Dad!" "He can't help it," a little girl said.
"Can you hear me thinking, kids? Is that it? We sort of pick up thoughts, but it's not like you'd imagine, Dad. People don't think alike, and thought patterns are even more different than faces. You can't figure out what somebody else is thinking unless they know how to organize their thoughts to communicate, and we're still learning. But they can all feel your feelings, and your... It's embarrassing me, Dad."
"I can read thought," George said. "I'm getting kind of okay."
He looked quickly at Martin. "Not you, sir. I'd never do that."
"I better not catch you in my mind," a girl warned him.
"Oh, I'm not, Sylvie. I'm not."
"Of course you are. Anyway, we have no trouble reading you, morons. Any girl can do it. You don't need to have gotten zapped. You're transparent from birth, gentlemen."
She leaned her head against George's shoulder. George crossed his legs.
"What's this getting zapped?" Martin asked.
Silence fell.
"Dad, we want you to try."
"Try what?"
"Don't ask him, Trev. He has to."
"Shut up.
What's going on here?"
"Dad,
you remember the night when it happened?" "How could I ever forget it?"
"Mom was holding Winnie, and I was standing beside them. You had your hand on my shoulder. You were squeezing so hard you nearly broke it."
"I'm sorry."
"No, no, it was good. The light missed you. It hit Mom and sort of splashed on me. I went out of my body and up in the air. I saw you down there. I saw us all. Then I was out in the sky, up above the church. I saw Mom and Winnie. They were gold in the light, gold masses of sparks. And they were rising fast. But my shoulder hurt so much I went back down. At first, I was in shock. I went to the back of the church with Mom. I saw you, but you seemed far away. You were hollering at us. I never saw you like that, Dad. I felt so sorry for you. So sorry."
"I want your mom back. I want my girl." Another boy shook his shoulder.
"We're gonna win, Dr. Winters."
Martin recognized him as Joey Fielding, son of George and Moira, who ran Octagon Feed.
"That doesn't seem possible," he replied, trying to keep his bitterness and his resignation out of his voice.
"Every one of us had the same thing happen. We were in pain when the light hit us, and it didn't take all the layers. Who we were stayed with our bodies. What we lost were the lies, the hopes, most of our education, what we wanted, what we thought of ourselves, our hopes. We lost all the baggage."
One of the little ones said, "We're like fresh. We're new again, like we were."
"Look at him. You're scaring him," a girl hissed.
"I'm not scared," Martin said.
"Yes, you are. We're weird, and you're scared."
"He doesn't scare easy," Trevor snapped. "My dad has courage."
"He's gonna need it if we do this."
Martin was aware that this conversation was happening on two levels, one he could hear and another that he couldn't. I think I need to know what's going on. What's going on is we need you to try to become like us.
How would he do that?
It seemed like some sort of side effect of a failed attempt by the aliens to strip away a soul.
That's it, Trevor said.
I thought you couldn't read minds. He looked down at the smashed grass that made up the floor of the tiny chamber.
You're easy, Dad, 'cause I know you, George said.
It's getting dark.
Trevor looked at him sharply, shook his head.
Trevor, no, no.
What is this?
Trevor threw his arms around him. Dad, they want you to leave.
Leave? I can't leave.
A boy of perhaps 10 or 11 produced a pistol. He handed it to one of the older kids. Martin saw that it was a .45 automatic. He didn't exactly point it at Martin so much as leave it visible. Martin stared at it. He looked from the barrel to the young face. Those eyes again, all shadowy. These kids had changed. He gentled his voice.
Look, I need a break here.
The boy thrust the gun toward him.
Trevor? Trevor, tell them. I'm a good father. I'm... Kids, listen. I'm needed. You need me. Yes. Oh, yes, I can be... Can replace...
The boy racked the slide.
You helped me, Pammy. Hey, you just helped me escape. Now you want to do this? This is crazy.
Dad, if you don't go... Trevor pulled in his words. He was choking with tears. Martin could see it.
Trevor, tell them I can't survive out there. Nobody can.
The boy got to his feet. He had a dusting of beard, barely visible in the gathering dark. He held the gun in Martin's face.
Dr. Winters, he said quietly, you get out of here.
Oh, God, listen, please. I've been running and running. I can't run any more. Trevor, please help me. Help your dad.
Trevor looked at him out of his strange new eyes, and Martin saw the truth of it. The horror they had seen had made them monsters, all of them, and Trevor was a monster too. But then Trevor reached out a hand and touched his father's cheek. It was not the gesture of a boy, but of a man of maturity.
Dad, it's survival of the fittest. The reptilians are going to find you. You can't hide from them, not anywhere, not like we can. If you stay here, you'll lead them right to us.
Martin backed away from the gun.
Get that thing out of my face.
Dad, you have to do this.
Trevor threw his arms around his father. Martin held him, felt his body shaking. He looked to Pammy.
Why did you save me? How could you be so cruel?
She's a damn asshole, the boy with the gun spat.
Ride the storm, a voice said from the back. Same as we did.
Dr. Winters, Pammy, call me Martin, please.
Dr. Winters.
She pulled back the flap of the tent. Outside, Martin saw rain sweeping and almost continuous lightning, and shadows in the nearby clearing that did not look like any shadows he cared to see.
This is crazy. I can't.
Dad, do it.
Trev, no, absolutely not.
His son was standing before him, looking up at him, his face stained with tears.
Get out, he said.
He turned to the boy with the gun.
Give it to me, he said.
Why?
The boy asked, raising his eyebrows.
Because I'm the only one who can handle this.
He took the gun and held it to his father's face.
Decide, he said.
Martin looked straight down the barrel. He could see muscles working in Trevor's hand, could see his finger tightening.
Trevor? Trevor screwed his eyes shut.
Now, Daddy.
Martin tried to think. Some argument, some appeal. But there were no more arguments. There were no more appeals. That weapon was going to go off in another second, and Trevor was going to have to spend the rest of his life an orphan like all these other orphans, but knowing, unlike them, that he had taken the life of his own father. Martin raised his hand.
"I'm going," he said softly. "I'm going, son. And I want you to know that I don't understand, but I don't blame you. Just go. I know you have to look out for each other, that you can't risk the group.
Damn you, go!"
Trevor's voice was not the same now. He'd been so gentle a boy that he couldn't shoot a pheasant. Now here he was, ready to kill his father, and his voice was low and hard, scorched with the pain of somebody who could. Martin went out into the lightning.